This is the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
The Department of Defense issues, where we have so many political people involved with the Department of Defense at this point.
Oh, yeah. And, Mark Levine put forward an absolute master class on how to select a candidate this evening on his program.
Go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Three days of hooky are over, and I am back, and glad to be so. It's good to be alive. Oh, I'm so not down with air travel in America. First of all, I'm convinced that as a result of Ronald Reagan's deregulation of the airlines, most of the airlines that exist went out and purchased old planes formerly owned by the Wicked Witch of the West and her Munchkin Airlines. Munchkin National Airlines, where your knees meet your chin. God, you ever seen those pictures of the Inca mummies? You know, they find one every now and then sitting on top of a mountain somewhere in Peru, and its chin is always rested on and sort of in an egg shape, all scrunched up together and stuff. That's what it's like for a guy who's 6 feet two getting on an airline in America now. After you've taken your shoes off, after you've been back through the X-ray machine or the metal detector because you forgot to take your belt off, and after you've been back through the metal detector again and it still beeps and you have to look at the, you know, the IQ of freezing water TSA functionary and say, look, doofus, my jeans have copper rivets on them. Unless I strip. And then you go, oh, hell, this could be the cavity, or the cavity search goes down. No. Just look. Rivets. Okay, you go on. Okay. Oh, Lord, but you get the idea. So, I got to tell you, last night when I landed at Charleston's Yeager Airport, there was a light drizzle falling. There were howling winds up on top of the mountain where the airport is. And I got off of that little Saab aircraft, and I kissed the ground of West Virginia. Oh, man, did we have a flight back from Dulles. Got on the plane. We're rolling out to the tarmac. It's too late to say, screw this, I'm renting a car and driving home. When the pilot announces, well, there's a lot of storms centered over West Virginia right now, friends. And it looks like we're going to have a little bit of a bumpy ride going into Charleston. Now, a little bit of a bumpy ride, at least in my frame of reference, is a potholed back road here in the hills and hollers. Apparently, however, to this pilot, a little bit of a bumpy road meant that we would make our approach to Yeager Airport in a fashion most reminiscent of being in a B-17 trying to dodge flak over Berlin in 1945. He did a good job, the pilot.
And, you know, I guess I've got a little bit of a control fetish. I like to drive. I like to be in control of things. I don't like to be a powerless passenger. And that's something that horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner and I will just have to go over at some point and just work out in my own head. It may involve better living through chemistry at some point, just to, you know, get a, you know, couple of good whacks of Valium and a good scotch down me before, you know, before I get on the plane. But I'm hyper conscious of it because I'm sitting there all cramped up again like an Incan mummy. And the thing is bobbing and weaving and howling all over the skies. And, you know, it's one of those turboprop affairs. I'm sitting by the window over the wing having reminiscences of William Shatner in that Twilight Zone episode, looking out on the wing and seeing the evil demon out there pulling the rivets. And so it wasn't a fun flight. And let's see, what are the three different forms of movement you can have in an aircraft? Let's see, there's pitch and yaw and roll. There were a couple of times last night that we did all three at once. I felt like Yossarian in the bombardier nose of the B-24 in Catch-22. Climb, you bastard, climb! Now, I'm not afraid to fly. I get on the plane, I strap in, everything's cool, everything's fine. But I don't ride roller coasters, and I don't do the tilt-a-whirl, and, you know, you can seldom even get me on the kiddie roller coaster at a carnival. Because I'm, you know, sitting back there in steerage, I'm powerless. And in the worst of it all, I turn to, because you know how my sense of humor runs. I turn to my traveling companion and, appropriating that great line from that great movie, said, "Jimmy, you ever seen a grown man naked?" "You ever seen Greco-Roman wrestling?" Oh, it was fun. Now, we flew from Charleston to Dulles, and from Dulles to Albany, New York. Picked up a car, an economy car, again built by the Chevrolet by General Motors on plans appropriated from the Munchkin National Auto Company. My knees were, you remember way back in the day when you knew you oughtn't, but you wound up driving with your knees anyway because your hands were busy with other things? Well, that was just, that could have done that all the way from Albany to Williamstown, Massachusetts, just because the car was so tiny. And as a consequence, I'm sitting here talking to you this evening, and I have, like, I don't know if it's a pinched nerve or slip disc or just a bad, bad muscle pull, right kind of where your neck joins your shoulders. So my head's sort of about halfway hunched over, and I feel like I'm talking to you like Truman Capote. That's not writing. That's typing. But what a marvelous trip it was. All kidding aside. And trust me, I'm not kidding about the flight into... I'm grateful to that pilot and co-pilot, or whatever they call themselves these days, from United Express, operated by Colgan Air, that got me from Dulles to Charleston. And they flew around the storms, and I could look out the starboard window where I was, over the wing, past the wing, and see this humongous miles-high wall of clouds with lightning streaking through its center. Honest to God, it was like the strobe lights in God's Little Gay Disco. And I'm thinking, no way we're flying into that. And we didn't, until the very end. But what a marvelous trip we had. Went to Williams College. Another representative from Coal River Mountain Watch and I did. She was a great traveling companion, too, by the way. Really, really good. Really, really good person. A lot of great conversation along the way. And we participated in the Focus the Nation events that, 1,600 different campuses had Focus the Nation events, trying to get, start a sort of an organic groundswell of consciousness about the need for addressing sustainability, the need to address green energy methods, and to become cognizant of where our current energy policy has taken us, and that's sort of where we came in. Because you really do find out that there are a lot of people out there that don't know a blessed thing about mountaintop removal. And I met, the students there that I met were just, they gave me hope. And I say that in all sincerity, they gave me hope. Because they're excited and energized to try to do something to bring an end to the monstrous practice that is mountaintop removal. And the ethnic cleansing that goes along with it. Thanks to the little tool that exists at ilovemountains.org, we were able to put the website up on the projector screen and type in, because you got to, this is in the upper Williams College is in the upper northwest corner of Massachusetts. You can throw a rock from Williamstown, Mass, and hit Vermont, and it's about a 12-mile drive to the New York line on to the west, over one of the most beautiful chunks of the Appalachian Mountains that I have ever seen. And Williamstown sits in this little broad valley between the Taconic Range that is Vermont and the Berkshire Mountains of Massachusetts. And it's gorgeous. Even under the circumstances that we were there, which was gray and rainy and, barely any snow on the ground, certainly they can tell that their climate is changing. It was beautiful. The college was founded 1793. Just a wonderful place. And the students there are, you don't just get in there. It takes a lot to be admitted. And they were excited to do something, to make a difference, to talk about sustainability. But they live in they go to school in a world, in a corner of the world, that it was utterly, and this is no disrespect, utterly alien to me. Because I've never been in a place where people of almost all stripe, all walks of life, are actively engaged in caring deeply about how they live and how they function within their community, within their village. The town leaders of the township of Williamstown, Massachusetts, for instance, have something that I just adored. They have a town resolution that says no franchise can set up shop inside town limits. No Dunkin' Donuts, no McDonald's, no Jiffy Lube, no Rite Aid, no Walgreens. If it's a franchise, it can't be there. So if you go to the pharmacy down on Spring Street in Williamstown, Massachusetts, because you need your prescription refilled, you walk into Hart's Pharmacy there, and it's run by these people named Hart who have a pharmacy. And they fill your prescription, and they know who you are, and you mean something to them, and that business means something to the community. There are wonderful restaurants. There are little boutiques. There's an ice cream parlor, a newsstand, and the newsstand is locally run and locally owned, just like everything else in that little town. Because it matters to the residents of Williamstown, Massachusetts, how their town develops and how their town sustains itself. And they have the fundamental understanding that you don't sustain yourself by bringing in business that will ship all the money that is spent in the business outside the town. And all around Williamstown, Massachusetts are farms. I had a lovely conversation with a lady who, along with her husband, run a subscription farm, which is a fascinating idea. They run they farm 7.5 acres, and the nature of their lease says that 1/3 of every acre must be left fallow during any given planting period, so they have constant crop rotation. And they have subscribers, the local residents of the surrounding area, who come to them and sign on and pay a monthly amount. And then as the things come in, and they've got something growing just about year-round, and as the stuff comes in, you get a call that says, you know, come get your basket. And they grow all manner of things. And it is intensely personal and intensely sustainable. Dairy farms were, well, let's put it this way. There was a dinner on Tuesday evening at the Williams College president's home, President Shapiro, and it was a beautiful thing. The reception for all the people who had participated in the Focus the Nation teaching activities, in green industry people, green agriculture people, my companion and I from Coal River Mountain Watch. A good room full of about 100 people or so, the students who had organized the Focus the Nation event. The hors d'oeuvres, let's see, what were the hors d'oeuvres? I don't mean to bore you, I want to tell you about the only way I can I want you to see what I saw. This beautiful, beautiful New England community tucked into a valley of the Appalachians that are not being blown to bits. The hors d'oeuvres came around during the cocktail hour prior to dinner, and they were, let's see, there were little tiny potato pancakes with dollops of apple butter, and both the potatoes for the potato pancakes and the apple butter had been grown locally. There were little mushroom caps locally, organic. All this was organic. Little mushroom caps stuffed with soy sausage that were just delicious. Oof. I had two. Local, organic. There were tempeh hors d'oeuvres that were organic and delicious. We sat down to dinner. No, they haven't gotten around to making their own scotch yet, so you know the people in Scotland are still safe. We sat down to dinner, and the first course was a beautiful pumpkin, spiced chilled pumpkin soup. Again, organically grown, locally grown pumpkins. That was followed by the entree, which was a beautiful organic rice pilaf. Wild rice pilaf. I don't think they're quite to the point where they can grow rice in the Berkshires of Massachusetts yet, but give them a chance. These dedicated people will find a way to try. There were organic Brussels sprouts as well, and then a chicken breast that was free-range and pan-seared in with a just a light, gorgeous breading and a bit of a what seemed to be a lemon and herb a flavoring arrangement and artichoke hearts. The chickens were free-range chickens, organic free-range chickens from nearby Vermont, and I would not be surprised to find out that the chickens had counseling before they were slaughtered. The practices are so sensitive to all the exigencies that transpire when humans eat further down the food chain. Dessert was a pear tart made of pears, thinly sliced on a beautiful pastry, all locally produced, and covered with a dollop of sweet cream maple ice cream produced from the local dairy and the local sugar trees. And all around me were people who were actively engaged and involved in not just thinking about change, but thinking about working on change and how that work needs to go forward. And I sat there looking at it,
and just taking it all in and marveling at it and wondering if it's just something special about that corner of the world that enables them to do things this way, or if it is something deficient in the rest of the country, most of it, that prevents us from doing it that way too. Because it is the right way to go about things. Growing up in Alabama, one of my first memories of learning history, because it was one of the first good giggles I ever had as I sat at my mother's knee being read to from a 100-year-old little history book, was the story of the Southern legislators leading up to the Civil War who proposed that a giant ditch be dug around Massachusetts so that Massachusetts might be floated out to sea and those abolitionist scum removed from the Union. And it was, you know, for a three-year-old, it's a funny image. But there is a profound ignorance in the South, and I would even say as far as up to where I am now in West Virginia. New England is, for all intents and purposes, a different country. And when you look at the overt, ham-fisted attempts to divide this nation as perpetrated by the Republican Party over the last God only knows how many years. When was the first time that Massachusetts liberal made its way into the lexicon? Was it during the Reagan administration? Or was it earlier? I think that the power elites in places outside New England, and I'm generalizing and I know it and I apologize, saw the way that whether they be Vermonters or New Hampshireites or Mainers or Massachusettsians or Connecticutians or Rhode Islanders, if I missed any, look at their world. And that the way they look at their world is dangerous to the lifestyle that the power elite have made for themselves in the rest of the country. You can't have the guy who sweeps the gym showing up and standing eyeball to eyeball with the guy who has all the power and telling him he's crazier than a run-over dog. But that happens in New England. Look at Brattleboro, Vermont. They've had over 7,000 emails since they started, since they announced their intention to put the arrest of George W. Bush and Richard B. Dick Cheney on the agenda for their town meeting. 7,000. And it's running largely in favor of. But people all over America writing into the city fathers and mothers of Brattleboro, Vermont, saying, do it! Please, for God's sakes, do it! Because here, wherever it is that I live, nobody has the guts to talk truth. And it's inspiring to me. It's a beautiful thing. So, in this little community, I was able to take that tool that I mentioned earlier at ilovemountains.org and type in the zip code for Williamstown, Mass. And hit click and click the what's my connection to mountaintop removal button. And the look on people's faces when I said, you know, look, this is a very progressive community. You guys pay a lot of attention to how you live and what kind of footprint you leave on this planet. Do you reckon you've got a hand in mountaintop removal? And we clicked, and I said, well, let's talk about Debord, Kentucky. And the mountaintop removal mine there that ships its coal to Massachusetts Electric Company. And there was an audible noise in the room when people realized that, yes, tucked away in that beautiful mountain valley in the far northwest corner of Massachusetts, that they
unwittingly, involuntarily, and certainly contrary to their good sense and their best intentions, were compelled to participate in a war on a people in mountains to the south of them, who, in many instances, had family that went back inside those mountain valleys as far back as the earliest settlers themselves had in that far northwest corner of Massachusetts. I must admit, you know, early on I took some geographical bigotry with me because it was as far north as I have ever been in my life. I jokingly said, you know, if I'm not back in 3 days, send a posse and cornbread. Because I'm going up amongst the Yankees. Well, I got to tell you, I'm pretty daggum fond of the Yankees. Granted, a little bit more taciturn. Not quite as chatty as a Southerner is. But it's cold up there, and talking takes energy. Why elaborate when, yeah, we'll do the job? Seems so. You'd think. But there in the far northwest corner of Massachusetts, they have their own issues. Because I said, look, you know, I saw Massachusetts. I thought I was going to Boston. And the fellow I was talking to, rather of an old-timer, said, that's all right. Massachusetts. People think anything west of Boston, for all they know, we could still be fighting Indians. They don't even know we exist here. And I'm only approximating the accent because I didn't have time enough to hang out and really get a good handle on it. But it was musical. It was musical in its own right. I love the varied and different forms of speech that English that developed in the United States. Consider that you get a group of English speakers, largely similar. One group winds up in Massachusetts. Another group winds up in Virginia within 20 years of each other, 1607 and 1620. Followed shortly thereafter by a persistent migration. And they both speak the mother tongue, and they come from similar places with slightly different accents. And they wind up being the riverine dialect of Old Virginia that goes on into the hills and hollers of West Virginia. No, you can't do that. And you get that accent from us. And then it turns into something completely different up there. And it's just fascinating to ponder for me. Sorry, this is my linguistic geek moment. But I was filled with hope. And I was filled with inspiration. And I knew coming away from a place like Williams College that we will win this fight. And I was pleasantly surprised when I arrived home. Let's see, I was filled with hope, I was filled with inspiration. Then I got on the plane in Dulles and I was filled with terror. But we've talked about that. But I got home and I got a little bit more hope because I saw a press release issued. A very brave man who has been on this program way back in its early terrestrial radio incarnation days. A West Virginia state senator by the name of, dadgummit, by the name of John, well, his name's John. No, I'm kidding. John Hunter, John Blair Hunter from Monongalia County, West Virginia, up where the state university is at WVU, where they're not doing any mountaintop removal just yet, has introduced something called State Senate Bill 588. And John Blair Hunter's State Senate Bill 588 outlaws, plain and simple, outlaws mountaintop removal in West Virginia. Now he's looking for sponsors. And like Lot seeking one honest man in Sodom, he may well go empty-handed. We have yet to see a sister bill introduced in the House of Delegates, but I have faith that it will be.
I certainly hope that it will be. And I will do whatever I can to support both John Blair Hunter and whomever introduces similar legislation in the House of Delegates. But that was very good news. That was very good news. And there is hope. What did Gandhi say? First they ignore you, then they ridicule, then they fight you, then you win. We're about a step away from winning. One of the things we told the students there at Williams was that in the House of Representatives is sitting a bill called the Clean Water Protection Act. It, too, would effectively eliminate mountaintop removal forever. In the United States House of Representatives, the Clean Water Protection Act has 125 co-sponsors. Those students and faculty there at Williams College were proud when we told them that all 10 of their Massachusetts congressional delegation had done the right thing and were, in fact, co-sponsors of that legislation. And then they looked at us in slack-jawed horror when we had to explain to them that neither Shelley Moore Capito, Alan Monahan, nor Nikki Jo Rahal, all the House delegation from West Virginia, none of them had co-sponsored the legislation. Because, of course, they are bought and paid for by Big Coal. Have you seen the movie Idiocracy? At one point, one of the cabinet members in Idiocracy every so often has to stand up and say, "Brought to you by Carl's Jr." And someone asks him, why do you keep doing that? Well, they pay me to. I think we should require West Virginia's congressional delegation at the beginning of every remark in the House of Representatives to say, "Brought to you by Big Coal." Why do you keep saying that, Congressman? Because they pay me to. We will win this. With your help, we will win this. With the help of folks like I met in the last 3 days, we will win this. And it's so exciting to realize that. Now, the next step, we also have to begin preparing, though, for what comes after that. The person who was the featured speaker after the dinner Tuesday evening was a man by the name of Christopher Flavin. He is the president of the World Watch Institute. They're quite well known and have a pretty high profile. Their gig, if you will, is to examine the energy future of the world and to discuss issues of sustainability and environmental sanity and as it intersects with national energy policy. He delivered an absolutely fascinating address. I hung on every word. Or did I hang? I'm not sure. But on more than one occasion, he remarked that coal simply cannot be a part of a sustainable energy future for America. And he made that abundantly clear. And I learned things listening to him that I had not known before, which, of course, is the high water mark of listening to somebody who's a lot smarter than you. See if you can sort of bogart off the smart. And I didn't realize it, but he pointed out, and I think I've got the number right, that since the energy crisis of the 70s, even though population has gone up in California, electricity and energy usage has dropped by 50% just because of good government initiatives led by committed people demanding good government. And he said, "Trust me, I go to California a lot, and there's nobody shivering in the cold or burning up in the heat. Mainly, it's just a matter of," he said, "more stringent, more closely managed building controls, for instance.
creating public awareness of where energy comes from. And that was one of the analogies that I used. And we've talked about it a lot on this program. There, most Americans, especially Americans in the city, think that chickens and steaks come from the grocery store. And they never think about the free-range little birdie running around on the high prairie plucking at worms or whatever. Or the cute little cow, the cute little spotted cow that turns into cute little steak. By the same token, a lot of America still thinks that their electricity comes from that switch on the wall. And when they want it, they flip it, they get it, and when they don't, they turn it off. Or more times than not, they just walk out with it still burning. And that's our challenge. To make people understand that electricity doesn't come from the switch on your wall, and that it does matter when you leave the computer running when you're not going to be using it for several hours. Matters. Or the TV. Or forgetting to turn the electric stove off, the electric oven off, after you've already taken the cake out. But one of the things I think that an organization like World Watch should actively engage in is the question of how we, because ultimately it's the ultimate question of how to end mountaintop removal, and that is how we shift away from a monoeconomy in the Appalachians. How do we get to the place that, for instance, a lot of Europe is in? Chris Flavin noted, among other things, that a lot of Austria, for instance, has switched over to pellet furnaces with the wood pellets that are made from compressed from sawdust from sawmills, which therefore qualifies as a bioheating source. How do we do that here? How do we do that on a grand scale? How do we raise awareness? How do we look at the people? And listen, you know, this is a tough job and a tough problem. And I'm not trying to be elitist or anything, but how do you look at a guy who was a high school dropout, who couldn't have gotten into so much as community college, but took a job learning to run a bulldozer on a mountaintop removal site and finds himself making $60,000 a year on a non-union job? How do you look at that guy and say, listen, I can get you another job making the same money, and you don't have to destroy the world in order to accomplish it? Where are those jobs? We have got to have those jobs in West Virginia. If we're going to defeat mountaintop removal, we have to create a means of employing people at a rate of pay that is lifestyle sustainable. And that is the great challenge. But it all comes together. They say that Einstein was searching for the unified field theory when he died, everything that would elegantly tie everything up in one nice tidy bundle. And that he didn't find it, maybe it's the philosopher's stone and it really doesn't exist. But to a certain extent, it does exist in the realm of what we're talking about here. There is a unified field theory, and its discovery lies in the recognition of something that I've talked about for a long time, which is that all of our issues have to combine into one. Economic justice is a function of gender justice, of sexuality justice, of environmental justice, of labor justice. They all form a cohesive whole if we will bother to look at it and see it that way. Education justice, economic justice, class justice. Everything pulls together in a way that where each element compliments another. And that was sort of the light that went on for me while I was up there. I could have stayed for 2 weeks. There was so much to be learned, not for me to tell people stuff, but stuff for them to tell me. Yeah, how do you create this community? Heavenly Days, was it a fight to keep McDonald's out of Williamstown, or did it just sort of come natural? You know, we don't want those hateful arches in our town. That kind of stuff is worthy of a lifetime's dedication and years and years of concentrated study. I feel renewed. I really do. Well, except for the Truman Capote head laying on my shoulder, crick in the neck from the terrifying airplane ride sort of way. I feel renewed. But enough about that. Let's see what you want to talk about this evening. You know the phone number, of course, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, HEADON, head on, or on your own unlimited long-distance dialing plan if you've got one, 304-658-3333, 304-658-3333. We go to the phones.
Hi there.
Hey, Susan.
Your first mistake was getting on Puddle Jumper.
Well, like I had a choice.
That's true.
You fly the plane they bring to you. You don't get a menu. Oh, I'll take the 747 from Charleston. Yeah, they don't land them there.
Yeah. I would be really, really careful about those pelletizing plants. We live just down the street from one. And we are currently suing it as part of a class action because, well, among other things, one day my husband walked out the door and his lungs shut down because of the sheer amount of sawdust they were pumping into the air.
Then they're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
That's not an indictment of the fuel source.
No, that what I'm saying is you have to be really careful that they have to be checked, monitored, and regulated.
All industry does. Because, especially here in the United States, Susan, because industry is not for purposes of putting out a product, but rather for purposes of enhancing a quarterly stock dividend.
Oh, yeah.
So the process that will make it safe and make it clean and make the plant that makes the things a good neighbor go out the window if there's a thousandth of a cent extra to be made on it. These are truly economics of both micro and macro scale.
Yeah, I'm hoping that once we get a Democrat into the White House, the regulatory climate will change, especially if we can get John Edwards in as Attorney General. That just warms the cockles of my heart.
I still want him on the Supreme Court, but we'll agree to disagree.
Well, Supreme Court or Attorney General, either way. Sherman.
But you say when we get, well, you said, no, you said once we get a Democrat in the White House.
Yeah.
That's a horse of a different technicolor, Susan.
That's thinking on my part. That's positive thinking on my part.
That's positive thinking on your part, but I tell you what, seeing what I'm seeing, the likelihood, and this is my, Norm the Negative Guy moment, I think we're getting very close to having to get used to saying the phrase, President McCain.
Yeah.
Because and I say this just because of the sheer numbers. What did 37, I think, percent of the eligible voters in this country, 37% say that they would never vote for Hillary Clinton. Never. As evidence of this, granted, we're talking about the media here, and we're talking about the story that the media are trying to generate. I saw heard a soundbite from a woman who said, well, I guess if Hillary was running against Osama bin Laden, I might vote for her. Might.
Well, Yeah. These people had better grow up and figure you can either have a Democrat, be it Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, or they can have another 40 years of Republican rule, because that's what they'll get.
Consider this. We're down to, as of today, with Willard Romney bowing out, we are down to a two-person race on the Republican side, and it is Insane McCain and radical fundamentalist cleric Mike Huckabee.
Yeah.
And yet the media are painting this as, you know, McCain as a shoe-in. On the other hand, we're down to a two-person race on the Democratic side, and the media are painting it as, well, it's going to be a horse race to the very end. Does that make you scratch your head a little bit, Susan?
Yeah, it does. It's goofy. It's totally goofy. But these people need to grow up and decide what they want. Republican rule for the next generation and a half, or a Democrat who can start cleaning this mess up. Whether it's Hillary or not, I don't care. It's a Democrat. I'll vote for it if it's Beelzebub.
That's where I am. I am voting for the Democratic nominee in November, come what may. Because, among other things,
after the name, I don't care.
One of the things that the media are also now doing is they have resurrected McCain's reputation as a maverick. He will buck his... I'm sure you've followed this business of, Limbaugh and all the other right-wing freakazoids who are having kittens with crocheted tails on the air every day because McCain's going to be the nominee.
Oh, yeah.
Wrestling.
Pure wrestling.
This is, please, Brer Fox, don't throw me in the old briar patch.
Yep. That's exactly what it is.
And it is designed to take independents and make them think that, you know, McCain is a moderate. You know, he's one of these bridge builders. We could like McCain. This is because it's a win-win for the Limbaughs and the Hannitys and so forth. Because if McCain does win, then they get to gripe. They don't have to worry about supporting the Limbaughs and the Hannitys and the O'Reillys. And the Bortzes and the Ingrams and the Coulters are all so sick of having to carry water for George Bush. And if they got to sit there and take pot shots at John McCain for however long he survives in office before we get President Huckabee?
Yeah. That's what I'm really scared of.
See, that's why Huckabee is saying he's staying in the race.
Yeah. He wants to be vice president, and he expects McCain to keel over.
Huckabee needs to maybe pick up, he'll pick up Mississippi. So
probably Texas.
I don't know that he'll carry Texas, but he'll get enough votes to make it appear that he can draw votes there.
Yeah.
And he will draw them from a place that McCain can't draw them, so that he becomes just about a lead pipe cinch for the vice presidential nominee. And remember, this is how the arc of the Mike Huckabee rise to power has already played out. He was lieutenant governor to Jim Guy Tucker in Arkansas when he was removed from office. Mike Huckabee fell into the governor's office in Arkansas.
Yeah, if I were McCain, I would immediately employ a food taster.
But right now, McCain is I think more interested in via back channels making it understood that Huckabee has an inside track to the vice presidency.
Yeah, because that way he won't attack him.
Well, that it's such a beautiful piece of wrestling.
Oh yeah.
And what a con Super Tuesday was. And it was meant to be a con from the beginning, so that we'd have, Hillary and Obama are neck and neck, they're neck and neck, they're into the home stretch, and it's Hillary on the inside track, and Obama charging hard from the outside. And that's the way it's designed to be.
Yeah.
Not by the Democratic Party, but by the media.
Did anybody ever declare New Mexico?
I got to admit, I'm the wrong guy to ask because I've been out of the loop. I didn't even take a computer to Massachusetts with me. I wanted to be focused on the task at hand.
Ah, okay.
So I don't know if they did or not. But
I do have one other thing to say. For those listeners in Washington, whoever you plan on voting for, do not think that by voting on February 19th, you will get your candidate delegates. Don't work that way. If you do not go to the caucus this Saturday, your vote don't count. The 19th primary is a beauty contest only. Go to the caucus, folks. That's the name of that tune.
I didn't know. Fascinating.
Washington has always been weird.
Now, careful. There's a lot of listeners in Washington. They might...
Hey, I was raised in Seattle.
Okay. You've got the street cred.
Washington has always been weird. I cheerfully admit it. And
but if we don't start mending some fences and healing some wounds,
yeah,
regardless of who the nominee is, whether it be Obama or Hillary,
we're in deep doo-doo.
Get used to saying President McCain.
Yeah.
Now, the other part of this, though, that I find just too ironic, almost for contemplation, is this idea that while the polling data suggested that John Edwards would have beaten John McCain like John McCain owed him money.
Yeah.
Hillary's 3 points down to McCain and Obama's 1 point down to McCain, or vice versa. It really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So that we have another one of those so-called dead heat races. And the media can pimp it for 9 long months.
Yeah, what I find interesting is the amount of votes that were cast for Edwards in California. Now, admittedly, a big portion of those votes were early votes, but a lot of them were basically defiance votes. And the Democratic Party should pay attention to that. The candidates should pay attention to that. Because that's how much support there still is for John Edwards. They were willing to throw their vote away.
Well, or perhaps not throw their vote away, Susan, so much as vote for the person they actually wanted.
Yeah.
As opposed to being painted into a
corner.
Yeah, into a political corner with you have only two choices.
But there was a huge Edwards vote, even though he was out. I think he got over 10% of the vote in California. That's a lot of votes.
That's a lot of voters.
Yeah.
So.
Anyway.
Yeah.
I am going to let you go because I'm sure there's other people trying to get in.
All right. Well, I forgot what I was going to say. I'm sorry. To be honest, Susan, Agnes made me take a muscle relaxer early this morning because I was in agony with this thing in my neck. And I still feel
like... In other words, you're stoned.
I'm not quite yet, but I'm not all here.
Hey, enjoy it while it lasts.
Yeah, that's the thing, though. It wasn't any fun. It's not like I wanted to put on Dark Side of the Moon and put the headphones on and listen to the stereo separation in the separate parts of my brain. This stuff just these were the muscle relaxers that I refused to take when my lower back went south, and I just figured I'd gut it out. But you know, when it crawls up into your neck and your shoulders, it's like, no, I'll take it.
Yeah.
But all it did was knock me out. I just wanted a nap. You know, I felt like the cowardly lion in the poppy field. Oh, this is a nice place to lay down for a little bit. Oh.
Well, look at it. Is there going to be is Peter live today?
Peter is live this evening. So I assume there will also be a horn section.
Cool. we definitely got to get the horn section on the archive. I could listen to those over and over and over again.
We're working on that. It's just that the hardest working man in liberal talk
is buried.
You know, I endorse human cloning if for no other reason than to make four or five of Ben.
I get six. He needs at least six.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Susan, you take care, dear.
Love to Agnes and the kids.
Sure thing. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
I'm not trying to be a nattering nabob of negativity, to quote that great political sage, Spiro T. Agnew. But unless the Democratic Party works hard, and I address this particularly to the people who think that Hillary Clinton signed the Constitution in invisible ink, you know, that you know, she's just that much of, you know, our future. And to the people who have become a part of the cult of Obama, I address myself specifically to you, because I don't have a dog in this hunt, so to speak, because my candidate was taken away from me. The people who are hell-bent for leather for Hillary and the people who are hell-bent for leather for Obama have had better start finding a way to come together, because if you don't, you're not going to get to say President Clinton, and you're not going to get to say President Obama. You are going to sit in sackcloth and ashes and tear at your hair every time your mouth opens up and just goes all dusty dry trying to say President McCain. It will not be my fault if we wind up with President McCain. It will not be the fault of any horn listeners if we wind up with President McCain. The fault will fall squarely on the shoulders of the diehard Hillarites and the diehard Obamanians who couldn't put the freakish political partisanship aside to unify our party. And since it is our party, not just the Hillary party and not just the Obama party, I, for one, will hold you people personally responsible for putting John McCain in the White House if you two groups don't straighten the hell up. You have my solemn word that I will go and vote for the Democratic nominee for president. You Hillarians, you Obamanians, can you say the same thing? Will you say the same thing? If you will say the same thing, by God, say it now. Say it loud. Say it frequently. Say, I am not a repig licking. I do not put my individual candidate first. I put the well-being of the nation first. I put my fellow citizens first. Please? Will you? Please? Can you? God, I hope so. Mercy. Because the single fact that exists is this. When it comes down to November, the Repiglican Party, for all of their sham division, will move like a monolithic juggernaut. They will, I promise. Let's go to the phones, see who we've got. Hi, who have I got?
It's me.
Who's me?
Hello.
Hello.
I'm Chris from Moscow, Idaho.
Oh, okay. Well, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I've home most of the time being handicapped, and so for the last couple of months, I've been listening to some of the Patriot radio networks on the internet. And I'll tell you, they're as funny as hell. They insist that Ron Paul is going to save the world, and everybody who doesn't agree with them is an idiot, and yet you can ask them the simplest questions about libertarianism, and they don't know anything.
No,
they're absolute morons.
The Paul people are, I referred to the Ron Paul people, I referred to the Obama followers as having a little bit of a cult flavor to them, but the real cult in this race is Ron Paul. These are true believers of the first stripe.
Yeah, but you should hear what they're saying about McCain. They're calling him a traitor. They're reading these long diatribes about how he gave in to the Vietnamese and made broadcasts that were against our troops. I'm loving it. I'm grateful to hear it.
Indeed. So, you know, you're in Idaho, Chris.
I can barely hear you.
I'm sorry. I don't know what could possibly... let's see if that may... Does that help any?
I'll try, but you're way down in the mud.
Oh, I don't know what the problem might be.
You know, that they call it the Communist Party. You know, Hillary Clinton is communist from that Communist Party. It's all the fault of that communist, Roosevelt.
Oh, Roosevelt, sure.
It's all his name. He was a card-carrying communist, and one-payer health plan is a communist idea. And the Federal Bank is a communist institution, and he just goes on and on and on that way all day and all night.
These are all tired old ideas from the John Birch Society, Chris.
Yeah, I realize that, but you know they're not interested in fact. They're only interested. They never read anything they disagree with. That's all passed from, you know, it's just so funny because, you know, everybody that disagrees with them is a nutcase and they know it all. And then, of course, they throw it in with fundamentalist religion, which all gangsters do, and it gets fun to listen to, although sometimes I want to tear my hair out. They won't let me on. I tried. Maybe my voice is not very good, but you never hear.
Hey, Chris,
it's not
your voice they object to. It's your ideas, my friend.
Yeah, well, they don't have any, but they're gloating today because they probably have it out. They said, aha, now they got to turn to Paul to be the Booker convention, and they're going to finally turn to Ron Paul, and we win.
Personally, I'm hoping, Chris, that Ron Paul will run as a third-party candidate.
Yeah, I do, too. But, you know, I've heard Ron Paul speak, and they say, Oh, what a great, intelligent voice. Rod, I've learned everything he said in the fifth grade. I mean, the man is a, let's face it, he's not very intelligent.
He's really not. All he's doing is, he's spouting stuff from Ayn Rand and libertarian think tanks. He's like an actor repeating his lines on stage.
I know it. And what the crowd will realize that this is a performance, and he's a lousy actor. That's why he's not getting anywhere. So, anyway, I think it's fun to listen to anyway. Oh, I've got one more question to ask you, Bob.
Sure.
I'm going to be right now. I have an application before the Federal Communication Commission to start an LPFM, low-power FM station. Kind of complicated. It used to be on the air, and I want to take it over. And I wonder if when I get it on the air, I could use your program.
We would be thrilled and honored, Chris. We truly would.
Oh, good.
And if you can get that LPFM license, you let us know, and I will immediately do what's necessary to make sure we never say any of the wrong words so that they won't bother your license.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. Okay, I'll get off now and listen.
All right, you have a wonderful evening. I'm so glad you called.
Bye, Bob. I'll
Bye, Chris.
Back sometime.
Okay, great. Good to hear from
Bye.
You. Bye now. Love hearing from new callers. And when I hear progressive voices from places like Idaho, I feel even better. Hi, who have I got?
Hey, Bob. How you doing, man? It's Gary.
Hey, Gary. How you doing?
Okay. I was listening to your impassioned plea for all of us to get along as Democrats.
Yes.
Yeah. And you were saying that you're going to hold people, probably like myself, accountable. But I would say to you, I'm also going to hold other Democrats accountable. And the Democrats I'm going to hold accountable are the Democrats continue to allow the Democratic Party to change rules inside the DNC to favor certain candidates who won't come out and support those candidates who are saying, let's have an end to this war. I'm going to hold those Democrats accountable too, because they are also contributing to this whole thing that's going on. The Democratic Party right now needs to have a contrast from the Republicans. We cannot win as a group, a collective group, if we have a bunch of Democrats like Nancy Pelosi and others who are willing to become Republican-like and expect people to come out and vote. It's a duality. It's not that we just always have to sit back and say, well, we're just going to take what they give us, Bob. People eventually are going to leave the party. We have to mobilize and push our candidate in our party and threaten to take our vote away from them if they don't do it. That's the only way, Bob, they're going to pull back. And we have to use that threat. I called the DNC today, and I told them point blank. I said if they go in and try to seat any of those Michigan delegates, when they told John Edwards people and Obama people that they would not be seated, but then they allowed Hillary Clinton to slip her name on there. That is favoritism, I'm sorry, to one candidate. And everybody's in these camps are now looking at this and say, wait a minute. I mean, I'm looking at John Edwards, and he's out. I'm looking at Dennis Kucinich. I'm looking at all our candidates that we really like, and they're out. And now we're stuck with what clearly starting to see now are already pre-rigged, in my opinion, candidates. I'm sorry, Bob, but that's just not democratic to me.
Nor is it to me either, Gary. I'm very disturbed by both the Mark Penn is Hillary's advisor, and he has been militating hard over the Florida delegates. And of course the Michigan delegates as well, because that would put some substantial space between her and Obama. But if the game was rigged at the beginning and there was an agreement through the DNC that those delegates would not be seated, then daggummit,
those delegates will not be seated. Now, I'm reading. Have you read this business now where they want Michigan to re-caucus or something?
Yeah, I heard about that. It's not going to happen. I called them. I talked to them today. They promised me. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
They promised me. I spoke with the chairman's office. They promised me that they were not going to seat those delegates. That's what they told me today on the phone. And I told them that I'm not the only person. I talked to a lot of people who are feeling the same way. Those delegates cannot be seated because the John Edwards people and the Obama people abided by the rules that they set. I just find it weird that the Clinton people just kind of seem like they have found some kind of way to get around it. And that's very disturbing to me.
As it should be. As it should be.
Now, that being said, we do have a decision to make come November. And I'm saying to you, at this point, I think there's some more Democrats who has to put pressure on the DNC to play this thing out fairly, squarely. And then if it's done that way, I think we'll be able to come unite as a party. If they do not play this thing fairly, squarely, get ready to say President McCain. That's just how it's going to be. People have spent a lot of time in these campaigns. They're out here trolling, volunteering. Nobody's going to just sit back and let somebody snatch their vote away. It's just not going to happen. And that's why I'm saying the DNC needs to get some balls and start just allowing the candidate, let the people pick who the candidate's going to be and quit trying to rig things the way they want. It doesn't work that way. And I don't even care for the superdelegate stuff.
See, that was the next place I was going, Gary. The superdelegates drive me crazy. The idea that I could go and vote in a primary and there would be some superdelegate who could basically disenfranchise me. Makes me just nuts. Do you realize that only today or maybe yesterday, the Democratic Party got around to taking away Joe Lieberman's superdelegate status?
Oh, God. He's an independent. He should have been automatically taken out.
It's called the Zell Miller Rule. And as of the moment that Lieberman endorsed John McCain, he was no longer entitled to be a superdelegate.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of weird. Well, Al Gore's sitting out there with superdelegates and obviously a couple others. So I think it could swing either way. I just don't like that, that kind of situation. But that's where I'm at right now.
Superdelegates, I understand, Gary, and superdelegates smack of the same kind of elitism that led to the birth of the Electoral College. We need to have, honest to goodness, popular votes for these offices. And superdelegates are, in the primary process, superdelegates are a way of defeating a popular vote.
That's right, 20% of the vote.
And that's more than enough to swing a brokered convention.
Yeah, I think if anything, if they were going to be fair about it, they should have said, well, it has to be within a 5% range. But if people are split and then the superdelegates, maybe I can accept that. But 20% is like a high threshold, you know?
And I think there should be a rule that no blood relative of a running candidate should be allowed to have superdelegate status.
Yeah, Clinton. Yeah, he has superdelegates. I don't know how many he has, but I would assume he has probably about 30 or 40.
Well, he is one, and he's the head of a camp just by virtue of status.
Yeah.
I don't know that we will ever see this circumstance come around again, where a spouse or, where a spouse or a child of a president, or an ex-president, is in the hunt for the office. I kind of predict that as American history unfolds in the coming century, we will see this more and more often because we are running down the slippery slope of empire, and empire tends to facilitate those kinds of circumstances.
I want to ask you one question, though.
Okay.
I've talked to a number of Democrats. What do you think? And I've talked to a number of Democrats. What really is the difference? And this, again, I'm not knocking Hillary or anybody like that, but she's a Democrat, but I just want to know when I'm talking to people, what really is the difference between, I mean, I know there's a difference between John McCain and Hillary Clinton.
That's a hard question. The easiest answer for me is the judiciary, as I've said time and time again.
Yeah, there was. I saw a quote just in the last 24 hours from McCain saying that he will. He promises. Maybe he said this at the Conservative Political Action Committee thing in the last day or so when he was getting booed. But he promised to appoint strict constructionists to the federal judiciary. That's code. That is code for appointing people who hate women's insides, who think that, well, all the issues that we so deplore. That's code for I will appoint more Scalias, Alitos, Robertses, and Thomases. So the biggest difference for me between Hillary and John McCain is their stand on the judiciary. I think John McCain and Hillary have a lot of separation where children's issues are concerned.
And why are the bullhorn radio hosts on the conservative side so anti him? It seems to me like they're scared he won't do that.
That the bullhorn business on the right, Gary, is a con job. It's good cop, bad cop. It's a fraud. It's Saturday night wrestling at the armory. It's don't throw me into the briar patch. It's a means of making McCain more appealing by making him seem less of the right wing freak that he is. They don't hate him like this. A McCain presidency is good for them because it gives them something to gripe at. Because these people, the Rushes and the Hannitys and so forth, A, conservative right-wing talk radio numbers are diminishing, not rising. It is flat at best. And so if they've got somebody to gripe at for 4 years in the office, their audience goes up. If they have to carry water, their audience either flatlines or goes down. And that's where they've been for the last 8 years, toting the bucket for George W. Bush. They want either, you know, seeing
well, they, I'm sure they would love, you know, that's why I keep saying, I don't know if it's about a Barack beating John McCain as much. They would just love to have Hillary in there so they could just talk forever for the next 8 years about Hillary and Bill.
Exactly.
I mean, they came to power during the Bill Clinton, you know, presidency because they were able to make him like the anti-hero, so to speak, and make themselves the hero. So I understand exactly what you're saying.
And they've been making and they've been doing the same thing preparing for Senator Clinton.
Exactly.
That machine is already in place to the point that right-wing talk radio, and I don't think there's any arguing with the fact that right-wing media, especially talk radio, has played a huge part in this. When you get a national number like what I heard and what I've seen, where 37% of the people who will go to the polls and will cast a vote in the presidential election say, and this is not just along party lines, mind you, say, I will never vote for Hillary Clinton, then you're talking about a significant portion of the electorate.
You know, the other thing is that, you know, when we was talking to your friend the other night, one thing, you know, I did agree with her, and I didn't agree with some of the stuff she was saying, but I did, one thing I do agree, there's definitely a lot of sexism out here, just as much as there's racism. You know, I definitely see it with guys or people that I talk with when they talk about Hillary. That other side does come out, which, you know, we still have a ways to go with that.
I'm convinced that my feelings about Hillary and Obama are not influenced even 0.001% by issues of gender or race. On the other hand, knowing what the Republican Party is and how they operate and who comprises it, I know for a fact that opposition to Hillary and Obama are significantly influenced by issues of race and gender.
Well, maybe Bob, what we need to do is just go ahead and let McCain get in there, let him put the judges in, let America just become the cesspool that is obviously heading toward, and then maybe they'll have some kind of revelation while they're sinking in the quicksand or something, and then maybe they'll ask for us to throw a rope to pull them out. I mean, because the way it stands right now, what I'm saying, the way everything's playing out, I think John McCain is going to be president.
That's not how empire works, though, Gary. Empire is not self-correcting. Empire can never turn back the clock. Empire never has. Empire collapses. And if that's, you know, if that's where we're going, then it's going to be a grim, grim century for you, me, our kids, our grandkids, great-grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. It's going to be a nightmare. It's sort of like global warming.
Yeah, but no empire was ever corrected either.
That's what I mean.
Half measures. It's always takes some kind of revolution. So we can't become the Republicans and hope to save the Republic. That's my whole point. We have to become the opposite of what they are to save the Republic.
And yeah, I do. It's largely a matter of maintaining stasis at this point, of running to stand still, holding on for as much as this galls me to say it, holding on to the status quo or what is left of it, so that we can begin making the corrections.
Well, see,
for those who say that Hillary's a Republican, that drives me nuts.
No, she's not a Republican.
She's not. She has never, to the best of my knowledge, cast a vote to end abortion. She has never cast a vote to actively oppose children's issues. Her work with the Children's Defense Fund is absolutely unassailable. She's right on a lot of the issues that matter to so-called liberals and progressives. So is, at least titularly, Obama.
Yep.
Those aren't the things that bother me. The things that bother me are the wishy-washy stuff that's being done to try to court the so-called independents, or the undecideds, or the middle-of-the-roaders. There are things that are broken in America, and we've got to actively talk about fixing them.
Well, this is where I would stand with this. I would say that I really kind of feel like that if there was a perfect way for us to do this, that the Hillary camp and the Obama camp, the one thing Obama is doing, he's doing a grassroots bottom-up thing, is what we really do need. Now, if Hillary could bring, and Bill Clinton could bring their expertise and their firepower into that grassroots and formulate a stronger union within the Democratic Party, then I think you could so much save the empire. But I just have a problem if they start trying to play Republican tactics just to win the small victory here against Obama. To me, that's not the victory. Whoever wins, wins.
And by Republican tactics, you mean changing the rules in the middle of the game, as you were discussing earlier.
Changing the rules, race baiting, all the stuff that they're doing that's going to divide the party. A house divided cannot stand. They should be just playing up our strength. And even if she was to lose to Obama, then come in, use Bill Clinton's popularity, his expertise, and build Obama up until we have a force to be reckoned with. And if she were to win and Obama loses, now you have a person that you can bring in his grassroots mobilization to really make change in America. Because he is bringing in Republicans and independents. So if you push them more to the left with his agenda, you can convert those people over to that agenda. But I think this whole, like you said, this bickering and changing rules and favoring one candidate, I mean, that's what they really marginalized Edwards. I mean, look what the media did to Edwards. They marginalized him. And the reason why they marginalized him, because part of the whole DNC's platform is to appeal to corporations. And we don't need that. Obama, look how much money he's raising. We can get more money from the people if we get them motivated than the corporations could ever give us. And Obama's showing that you can do that. And I think Hillary and them are just so bent on this fundraising type of, you know, big money thing. You don't need the lobbyists anymore. The internet's here. You can go door to door without even walking out your house to people.
At least theoretically, that's what Howard Dean began to prove, Gary, in the 2004 run-up to the primaries. It didn't carry through to what he had hoped for, but it sort of put a light on a path that no one had bothered to try to follow before.
And Obama's following that path, and Hillary and them should follow that path, too.
One of the things that I found interesting was a remark regarding the difference between the Obama and the Clinton campaigns insofar as it cast, or it suggested, that Senator Clinton is following the big state, big vote, you know, big delegate count strategy that has been the Democratic strategy for some time now, whereas I believe the phrase I saw was Obama's campaign is all terrain.
Yeah.
Now, if that characterization is in fact true, then I would think that not based on personalities, but based upon the voter outreach philosophy, I would think that Obama's strategy has got to have more appeal for someone like DNC Chairman Howard Dean, because
yep.
Dean went absolutely head-to-head with Rahm Emanuel
yep.
over the idea of whether we have a 50-state strategy or if the Democratic Party continues to try to build victories out of winning a handful of big states and telling the rest of the nation to, you know, kiss off.
And Dean was right, because in 2006 he proved when we all the districts we won. So and Rahm Emanuel wants to carry a lot of claim for that victory, but I mean I think that's a lot of the strategy that he had. And I think you're right, Howard Dean's going that way. But Howard Dean ain't all powerful, even though he's the DNC chairman. I mean, you still have a lot of Clinton people or whatever you want to call the people who influenced the DNC for the last 8 years. The Obama people really are relatively new to some degree, and or some people who were kind of frustrated for losing for the last couple of years. That's where you're really getting this kind of rift going with the direction the Democrats were taking because of the beating that we took with George Bush. So there was always going to be a split anyway because they were losing so many elections. So, you're going to see that coming after 2000. So I think what's happening now is that they need to really kind of figure out some kind of way to come together and resolve this situation of who's going to be the nominee and, figure this thing out. Because the reality of the fact is, if not, McCain is going to be, the candidate again, and God knows where he'll go. But for me, I still need some more clarification from the Clinton people where they are on Iraq and this lobbyist money and influence by this lobbyist.
The story about the over in whatever Istan it was, Uzbek or Turkmen or Kyrgyzstan, and the uranium deal that Bill Clinton went on is extremely disturbing to me. I don't know if you've read that or not.
Yeah, I heard about it.
It really hangs in my craw.
Well, I had this feeling that, my personal feeling, they're only, the Clintons are not necessarily rich. I mean, they are public servants. They only really, I mean, they're rich by me and your standards, but I mean, you're talking about somebody who probably got a net worth of 30 to 50 million. Whereas you look at somebody like Bob Johnson, he's like 1.5 billion. So I always had this fear that Bill Clinton and the Clintons were coming back to get paid. That was always in the back of my mind. Because you look at George Bush, he pretty much has been robbing the treasury for the last, 8 years. Basically, I mean, he hooked up his brother Neil with No Child Left Behind. You look at all the Halliburton, all his policies seem to be benefiting his friends. So I am kind of concerned that maybe the Clintons are coming back and saying, hey, you know what? I really didn't make a lot of money because they dragged me through the mud. I had to pay Paula Jones $800,000. I had to spend all this money on legal fees, and he walked out of office with barely any money. He only got money back when he started doing the speaking, and the books and stuff. So, yeah, that's a concern to me, personally.
And from the other side of the aisle, though, Gary, let me ask you this. I don't have the citation handy, but I have read that upon being asked whether she would support the Democratic nominee, whomever it may be, in November, Michelle Obama said, "I'll have to think about it."
Yes, she said. She's backtracked on it now, she said it.
So she has backtracked?
Yeah, but Obama also said, he doesn't know that the people who are supporting him will support her. And I think he's kind of backtracked on that, but I think what he was saying, there's some independents and Republicans coming over to vote for him, and he's, I guess he's hearing from inside his camp that they won't support her. So I think that'll have to be smoothed over. I think what happened was when the race thing came up, and I think when they started really lying about what he said about Reagan, I just think it just went so far that they started going kind of crazy. I mean, you can't say that you're not going to support the party candidate. I mean, you can't say that. That's up for me, a voter, to say, but if you're running for it, you can't say that. I mean, you have to apologize or you can't.
And there are a lot of people, especially young voters, Gary, who are taking their cues from Obama.
Yep.
where I was this past 3 days, I saw Obama signs everywhere. I did not see one. Not one Hillary sign. Now, granted, Hillary carried Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, she was going to carry it anyway. I mean,
but it's the but it's the, it's those young voters that are very, very important to me. And they do need guidance. And they do need to understand or be taught a bit about the process, such that it's important when somebody says, you know, I may or may not support the nominee. Because while I'm not trying to turn young voters into party apparatchiks, I also don't want to take that enthusiasm and that hope and just smash it on the rocks of political division. Make any sense?
Makes all the sense in the world. But on both sides, they have to get beyond the pettiness of race baiting, pettiness of saying I'm not going to support the party. They on both sides, because if one side does one thing, the other side always responds. If Obama says something that's not right, Hillary's going to respond. So they both have a shared responsibility. The problem is they don't seem to understand that, you know, because of ego or, you know, whoever want to be kingdom. They just seem to always, and you know what, to be honest with you, Bob, I think some of it's the surrogates kind of push the stuff. You know, I see some of the Obama people on the side doing things to say that, you know, and then he has to go and talk to them so they don't do that. And then you see the Clinton, Hillary had to fire a couple of people because they were doing things. You know, some of these people are on these campaigns are just out of control. And I think some people need to have a sit-down meeting with, you know, and say, look, we all are one party. If you don't agree with Hillary, that's fine, but don't go so far as to start calling people names and start doing things that you know are going to emotionally affect people. And it seems that people are going that far now.
And that's the reason for why I said what I said. As somebody who supported Kucinich and Edwards, I know my vote is going to wind up going to either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama in November, and I'm comfortable with that. I can live with that. I can live with myself over that. I cannot, however, live with these people who may very well, by virtue of their overzealous advocacy of one Democrat over another, hand me President McCain. Because after the convention, once we know who the nominee is going to be, I'm going to be out there hammer and tongs advocating for the election of that candidate. Even if I don't agree on all the issues, even if I don't agree on how we get from point A to point Z, because I may not be crazy about K or M or R, I know that we have to get to point Z. You see what I'm saying? And I trust either Senator Clinton or Senator Obama to get us there, as opposed to John McCain, who will trash the alphabet.
See, the thing is, American people right now are in a high state of anxiety and fear. They're losing their jobs. They're getting sick. Their homes are... So what happens is, just naturally, people are now at such an emotional level that once they connect to a client, I mean, I'm not declining to a candidate, like, let's say Obama, he's coming with hope. Now, if Hillary or Bill Clinton comes out and says, well, this is a fairy tale, even though that was taken out of context and twisted by the media, they're going to say, well, wait a minute, if you take away my hope and that's all I got left, they're going to go into this rant against this other candidate. That's just how it's going to be. And I think, like I'm saying, that the people in the Democratic Party, Howard Dean, them need to understand the American people right now at a high level of emotional distress, and that they need to, on their end, put out the notion to the people, put out the impression to the candidates, hey, tone it down, you know, tone it.
Well, I'll go you a step further, Gary. I think active steps toward healing have to be taken now.
Oh, yeah.
Because the convention is 4 days long. And that is not time to affect the level of healing that is going to be required to put up a united front in early November.
Well, did you see the debate?
Yes.
Now, even though I kind of felt like they were kind of acting together, when they were sitting there together and they're being, you know, nice to each other, I actually have to admit I felt a little bit better about them.
Well, I think I think the reason you felt that, and this is not because I have any special insight, this is just my speculation. The reason you felt that way, Gary, and the reason I felt that way, was because I sensed that while it may not have been me or you, somebody was getting through to them with the message that you're killing, by trying to kill each other, you're killing yourselves. And that maybe that had gotten home to them.
But, you know, the media the next day was, like, pissed off that there wasn't a cat fight. They were literally like, oh, so boring debate and all this other stuff. I didn't think it was boring. I thought it was interesting.
The media wanted the cat fight. That's why the media are creating this paradigm of McCain's got it in a lock now, but we got to sell the ads, so we got to have some sort of a horse race to the finish so that then we can have a horse race to November. This is all about keeping not voter but viewer interest between now and the conventions.
Yeah, I mean, I really wish. I'm kind of getting sick of it. I don't know about you. I'm getting a little fatigue on it.
Oh, I've had saddle sores since December because of the way they started this thing.
Yeah.
I well remember the fact that this campaign kicked off in February. This campaign kicked off a year ago. We've had a year of this muck to wander through. And it's beginning to tell on me. And based on what I'm hearing from my listeners, it's beginning to tell on them, too. They're not mad at me or mad at the program or mad at the network, but they're awful dadgum sick of being played for chumps by CNN and ABC and NBC and MSNBC and the CNBC and God knows Fox and, you know, the rest of the newspapers and even so-called liberal talk radio as it exists. There are people out there that are absolutely chapped with Ed Schultz, Rachel Maddow, Randy Rhodes, Stephanie Miller, because it's being perceived as a Hillary hate fest.
Yeah, well, one thing is that as long as Obama has a lot of money to spend, they will try to, the networks want him in the game, so you can expect that Hillary will take some hits from the media because they want that money.
Exactly.
So he's going to get some favoritism to keep him in the game. Now, when Hillary seems like she's falling apart, that's when he'll go after Obama. You know, it's all about getting that demand dollars. So,
we've already seen that. We saw that in the fallout after Iowa.
Yeah.
In the attempt to bring Hillary back into relevancy in New Hampshire.
What do you think about her using her own money now? They said that she's using her own money.
That she loaned her campaign $5 million. I read another story today that says that some of her top staffers are going without pay now. I don't know, Gary. I'm so jaded and so cynical about everything that comes out of anything vaguely resembling mainstream media that I almost just fail to even consider it.
But she's saying now that he's the establishment candidate and she's the underdog, because I just don't understand it. First of all, I thought after Tuesday it was going to be an automatic nomination for her. And now it's like everything's like backwards and twisted. You know, I don't understand what's going on. You know, this whole thing is like just totally, totally, totally weird to me. So, I mean, I can't figure it out for the light of day. One day it's up, one day it's down, one day it's down, one day it's up. You know, so, but.
Hey, it's the guy in the red trunks versus the guy in the blue trunks, and the blue trunks win on Saturday, and a week from Saturday at the next National Guard Armory in the wrestling match, it'll be the guy in the other pair of trunks. But at the end of the day, they all sit down and have drinks after the show together.
Well, I'll say this, Bob, and I'm going to let you go because I know you got other callers. Is this, wouldn't it be a beautiful thing? They came together, ran on the same ticket, and what would piss the Republicans off more? And put a black man and a black woman in the White Office, on the White House at the same time. And they'd be Democrat.
It would drive them to distraction. And, of course, that's...
Would they lose their minds? Do you think they'd just all just go crazy?
You could turn on MSNBC and see Chris Matthews' head explode in front of the television camera. It would just, you know, pop, you know, gone. Tim Russert would probably just have his organs start oozing out through his pores. But it would. But by the same token, it would be very, very good for them.
Yeah, and I would love to watch it. I just love to see them cringe every day. You know, they just bring back the economy, and everything just gets so better, and they just go away forever. That would be beautiful, man.
It would be. Hey, Gary, I'm glad. You know, I'm always glad because it always seems like you get it. At least it feels like you're working the same side of the street that I am. Because at the end of the day, it's the voters who are being abused by all of this. And I'm sick of the abuse.
Yep.
And I sense that you are too. And that sort of makes me feel a lot better.
We'll get there, man.
Yeah, we will. I think so. You take care, Gary.
All right, guys.
Bye now. Gary in Maryland. And, hi, who have I got?
Hi.
Hey, Juanita.
I didn't know if it was me or not.
If it's you on the end, I'm certain that it's you.
I didn't know whether you picked up on me is what I meant.
Oh, okay.
Welcome back.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I feel like I said, I feel like I played hooky all week, but boy.
Yeah, I really missed it.
It was refreshing. It was refreshing.
Yeah, that was great. I thought maybe I was the only one, but I'm like y'all. I'm getting weary. I'm so weary of all of this. This stuff with the, you know, whatever's going on with the candidates is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, right.
And I was kind of glad to hear somebody else besides me. But I just felt like today, I don't even want to hear about it. I felt so good when I saw that debate. And I thought, I hope that nothing will spoil this, because it gave me hope and expectation of help, as Maxine Waters says. And I wouldn't be surprised at anything the Republicans have in mind at all. I mean, I've said that before, and I'll say it again, because they're very devious people.
Yes,
but
they
you
are.
Know what? Some of the Blue Dog Democrats are devious too.
Sure, they are.
And I've been getting emails from the Florida Democrat Party wanting to know if I'm going to come to the party where they're going to try to get caucuses set up here.
What do you think?
I don't know what to think. I'm not going to the party, whatever, because I don't understand all of that. I mean, it was a big brouhaha down here, and I have no comprehension of it. And Guy James said the other day that there were people on Super Tuesday trying to vote down here. You know, I have the feeling like I should go and vote for something. It's so weird. I think, am I supposed to go and vote again? I don't know. But I just hope, I don't know. Like you said, if we do have President McCain, it won't be the United States anymore.
That's well, they'll still use the name, but it will be, a wholly owned subsidiary of, God, a continuation of a wholly owned subsidiary of Halliburton and KBR and Bechtel and the Carlyle Group, because it's just McCain runs on a continuum that goes from Barry Goldwater forward, all right? And whatever good Barry Goldwater had about him, McCain doesn't have any of it.
No, because Barry Goldwater was, I think he was true to himself. And certainly we've seen that McCain is willing to do anything, kiss anybody's ring, whatever.
McCain has taken to heart that idea from St. Paul that I will be all things to all people.
And you know, today he was supposed to be appearing in the in front of the conservative, wherever they are.
Yeah, the CPAC convention. I guess it's in D.C.
And they were telling them, asking them not to boo him.
They booed him anyway.
They did.
Yeah, I think I may even have that. I may even have that handy.
Isn't that where Romney dropped out? Isn't that the same place?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
He promised that if Hillary or Obama, you know, that, what a crappy thing for him to say.
Oh, he said some real crap.
He said electing Obama or Hillary, and this is a quote, would mean attacks on America.
Yeah.
Because they would retreat and declare defeat.
Mm-hmm.
About that, I have no doubt, he said.
Mm-hmm.
He's a sick one. Okay, I think I've got the audio here. Let's see if we can hear the conservatives booing McCain.
I hold these positions because I believe they were in the best interests of my party and country. Surely, I have held other positions that have not met with widespread agreement from conservatives. I won't pretend otherwise, nor would you permit me to forget it. On the issue of illegal immigration, a position which...
Yeah, that's not a few scattered boos in the crowd, is it, Juanita?
Yeah, you're right. It was about the immigration.
Because he doesn't hate those brown people enough. What a sick bunch those Republicans are, aren't they?
I know it. We've got a lot of sickness in this country. We really do. And we could have such a wonderful country. Such a wonderful country.
If they weren't hell-bent on destroying it.
Yeah, and that's what they are. And they don't think that they're going to be destroyed. I don't think. Do you? I think they think that they're going to be around. They're going to have all the money and everything. They're not going to have to make beds. You know, Karl Rove said he didn't want his son to have to make beds, you know. We needed those people from overseas to make up our beds and stuff.
I walked through the concourses at Dulles International Airport both on Monday and yesterday, Juanita. And, you know, there's a lot of restaurants and stuff there.
Uh-huh.
Those restaurants, and this is not a xenophobic moment for me. This is not about immigrant bashing. I don't immigrant bash. I respect people who work hard. I have all the respect in the world for them, regardless of the language they speak or where they were born, because I don't see Salvadorans or Guatemalans or Mexicans. I see human beings. And you know what? I didn't see many what you would call traditional Americans working the jobs inside that airport. I saw people whose native language was Spanish, or whose native language might have even been Filipino, or some other Asian tongue.
Mm-hmm.
And those people weren't working there because, as George Bush says, Americans won't take those jobs.
Right.
Those people were working there because those jobs pay such crappy wages,
right,
and are so hard to do.
Yeah.
That, yeah, Americans won't take the jobs.
Well, I blame the people who hire them, who don't want to pay. And I don't blame them at all for wanting to come to the... And, you know, when I think about it, my folks were migrant workers. They came down from Georgia to keep from starving to death to work in the citrus.
Well, I think
and they picked fruit and they did,
yeah,
you know, and worked in anything that they could find. And they were, and that's when you had no 40-hour weeks, you know.
No, a 40-hour week. A 40-hour week is a light week.
They were like 12-hour days, 6 days a week, 7 days a week, often. And if you didn't want to work all the time like that, but that's somebody else that doesn't care. And so I understand it. The people are not, because years ago I worked with migrant people, and some of them are very wonderful people and smart too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And
we in this country we have like it's. We're the smartest people, we're this and that and the other, And we're dumb in many ways. You know, we don't want to learn other languages. We want other people to learn English only. And when you think about, like in Florida, it used to be owned by the Spanish. Spanish was a native language.
Yeah, once all the Indian languages had been eradicated, sure.
Sure.
Same thing with Texas, same thing with Arizona, New Mexico, California.
And I don't that now if you go to Miami where the in fact I used to work for a PhD in education, and we would have to call all over the country, and if you call down to Miami they couldn't hardly understand you, and you couldn't hardly understand them because they spoke Spanish. That was their main language. And nobody's telling them to change their language. But everybody else is, you know, well, they're expected to learn English. Well, we ought to learn it. We ought to learn other languages here, in my opinion, in school. But
it's been proven time after time after time. It's been proven time after time after time, Juanita, that learning a second language expands the hardwiring of the brain like almost nothing else.
I think, don't you think, almost everything, like music and art and all like that. I know that I took humanities in college, and it made me learn so much about I understood myself better.
Sure, sure. And you see, Juanita, what you've tapped into there, I think, is a very, very important truth. And that is that when the Republicans talk about wanting to go back to traditional American values, they're not kidding. They're real about it, but the way they define traditional American values is an America where people work out of a desperate need to not starve to death.
Yeah,
we've seen this stuff before. We've seen low wages paid to people doing the hardest, dirtiest jobs.
Right.
And we've seen what that means. I can't begin to compare on issues of race. But my grandfather and my great-grandfather worked in coal mines. And working in those coal mines, they were not paid American money. They were paid in coal mine scrip. They were paid in coal mine scrip.
Yeah.
That could only be used at the company store.
Like that 16 times song.
Well, yeah. Because that came from truth. And the prices at the company store were all hugely inflated.
Yeah.
And so if you needed a new lantern for your hat, or if you needed a new battery, or if you needed carbide for your carbide lamp, or if you needed a new pick or a new shovel, that all came from the company store, and it was deducted from your pay.
Yeah.
If you were sick, you went to the company doctor. Now, that is an America that has existed, and it is an America that, for all they are worth, the Republican Party is working for 24 hours a day, 8 days a week, 370 days a year. They never let up.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely right.
Those people I saw working, I stopped for a hamburger. And I saw people working over a grill, a team going nonstop because it's constant customers there on that concourse in that airport. Constant, never any let up. And they're sitting there frying burgers, frying French fries, taking orders, going nonstop, never sitting down, never taking a break for a drink of water. And I guarantee you they're working for minimum wage if they're lucky enough to get that.
Right.
They have no health care benefits. They have no retirement. If they get hurt on the job, if they should happen to be so-called illegals, they say, "Boss, I got burnt." He says, "Too bad." And there ain't no workers' comp, and there's no unemployment compensation. All right? This has all been created as a function of the Reagan economic miracle and the Bush economic miracle, and these SOBs that hate these brown people but love them in their own sick, sort of sadistic, twisted way, because they make it possible for them to get insanely wealthy. And none of that wealth is ever shared back with the people who actually do the work.
Right. It it's just like the trickle-down economy. It occurs to me that that's the same thing as slavery. Maybe it's a nicer sort of slavery, but it's like the slaves, you know, they could only get whatever the people that owned them would allow them to have.
Right.
And if
free,
were,
you know, and but you know, and so if you're told, if you're told you're free, but you still can't leave, but you still can't stand up for your own rights.
Right.
You ain't free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would love to see the people working in those food service jobs in the airports. I'd love to see each and every last one of them a member of a union and getting paid decent wages for doing the hard work that they do. And you know, they're already charging. Let's see, the hamburger I had, a hamburger and fries was $10.
Oh my goodness.
Okay, it was a good hamburger. It was good fries.
It should have been.
But it was, you're darn right, at $10. And so imagine how many of those they're moving. Let's see, I saw 7 people making, doing all the work there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do the math real quick. That's, let's call it $7 an hour if we're lucky. So that's 49. That's 49.
That.
Yeah. But so there's 7 people, $7. That's $49 an hour. It's taking just in labor costs to run that place.
Uh-huh.
All right. Now, how many hamburgers are they moving an hour at $5 a pop?
Yeah.
So if they move 100 of those in an hour, that's $500, and their off-the-top labor cost is $50. Guess what? They can afford to pay more. The reason they don't pay more is because the people at the top who aren't doing any work want most of the money.
I was talking to these people that they have fruit stand or food of vegetable stand, and I think they get them direct from the farms because they're migrant workers. And I was talking one the other day about, he said that Bush had promised them a lot of things and he hadn't done them. And I said, "Or can you vote?" And he said, "Well, what difference will it make?" And I said, "Believe me, I said, if we get a Republican back in, it's going to be worse than it is now." And anyway, he was talking about how the people that own the farms say they can't pay you hardly anything because they won't make any money. And I said, "Well, I said they won't make any more money. What they're making money, but they want more. They want much more." It's greed, and don't care about anybody else. And there's a lot of that going on here in Florida, a lot of it.
And people doing that, trying to survive.
And then you've got the, well, they call them straw boss.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them, they're making it harder on them because they get a bonus. The less money they have to pay out, they'll get a bonus. And, you know, they make the people utterly miserable oftentimes, you know. And it's terrible. And like the little homes, the little houses and all, or little mobile homes, they'll rent it out to several people and charge each one so much, even the little children. They have to pay so much. It isn't one basic fee. And their place is about to fall down.
Yeah.
Just
and that is an America. That's my point, Juanita.
That's going back to yonder.
That is an America that has existed before, and that's what the Republican Party means when they say they want to go back to an America of traditional values. The problem is the traditional values that the Republican Party holds so dear are traditional values that normal people, working people, see as hateful, and for whom and for whose families they have sweated and bled and bones have been broken and families shattered trying to rise up from that crap.
Right.
But as long as they couch it in terms of family values,
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we want you to be able to go to church. Well, you know, I haven't seen any churches closing lately. But I see a lot of families that are absolutely struggling to get from day one to day two, and they do it every week. And every payday is one step away from disaster.
Right.
Because the Republican Party has had its dream come true.
Right. Right.
Sorry, preaching. My bad.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's, I want, you know, they say love it or leave it. I say love it and change it. I've always said that. Love it and change it.
That is the absolute truth.
I love my country. And I think that they, the people like them, I think they should, coming after you, Bob.
Probably.
You're that. and people that, like that, I think they should all go to their own country like Jim Jones did. You know, have their own country because they all want to think alike. They don't like anybody that thinks any different than they do. So, our country was based on personal freedoms. If I am any judge of what our Constitution says, you know.
But you can't have personal freedom if you're starving.
Pardon?
You can't have personal freedom if you're starving.
No.
Because that's not freedom.
But they want everybody to think alike. And that's awful boring. But I think when they say that we should go to another country, I think they should.
And I share your
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do.
And we've took all that stuff for a long time, the stuff they say to us. You know, that they say about us and to us. And I mean, we don't have good sense. We've got no traditional values. We've got no religiosity. We're just these horrible, horrible people. And that's what a lot of people are fed, and that they believe. They believe all this propaganda stuff.
Precisely. Juanita, thanks a lot. I'm going to take a little break here and
move
into the third hour.
And I'd love to hear more about what you had to talk about, too, at the college, you know, about your seminar or whatever.
I actually took the video camera and the highfalutin digital recorder with me, so if I can figure out a way to make it all sync up, heck, we might even put it on YouTube. You never know.
Okay, good. That'd be great.
And trust me, I've seen the video. The camera really does add 30 pounds. Or in my case, maybe 100. I'm not sure. So, take care, Juanita.
Okay, take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right, I got to admit, me and my Truman Capote-style neck need a little bit of a break. It's about 2 minutes after 8 o'clock. Your thoughts are, as you know, always, always welcome. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on, or if you've got your own unlimited long-distance dialing plan, save us a nickel or a buck at 304-658-3333. We'll be back after a little interlude. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
There is a young cowboy who lives on the range. His horse and his cattle are his only companions. He works in the saddle and he sleeps in the canyons, waiting for summer, his pastures to change. And as the moon rises, he sits by his fire, thinking about women and glasses of beer, and closing his eyes as the dogies retire, he sings out a song which is soft but it's clear, as if maybe someone could hear. Good night, you moonlight ladies. Rock-a-bye, sweet baby Jane. Deep greens and blues are the colors I choose. Won't you let me go down in my dreams? And rock-a-bye, sweet baby Jane. Now the 1st of December was covered with snow. So was across the turnpike from Stockbridge to Boston. Though the Berkshires seem dreamlike on account of that frosting, with 10 miles behind me and 10,000 more to go. There's a song that they sing when they take to the highway, a song that they sing when they take to the sea, a song that they sing of their home in the sky. Maybe you can believe it if it helps you to sleep, but singing works just fine for me. So good night, you moonlight ladies, rock-a-bye, sweet baby Jane. Deep greens and blues are the colors I choose. Won't you let me go down in my dream and rock up our sweet baby Jane?
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Don't touch that mouse. Strictly Confidential is LGBT radio. 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
The many colors in the homo rainbow. Don't be afraid to let your color shine. Many colors in the homo rainbow. Show me yours, I'm gonna show you mine.
Listen, man, adding fractions is no big deal.
Nah?
No. You just got to find what they call the common denominator. Let me show you.
All right.
Now, see these bottom numbers?
Yeah.
These are the denominators. That one's a 4 and that one's an 8.
Mm-hmm.
You just double both of these numbers so that becomes an 8, too. Then you add them up.
Man, you sure make this easy.
Charles Bennett always dreamed that after college he'd return to the old neighborhood as a teacher. But without the money for tuition, only half of his dream came true. He's back in the old neighborhood.
Well, enough math. I gotta deliver these sandwiches.
Oh, sure.
Please support the United Negro College Fund. Call 1-800-332-UNCF. A mind is a terrible thing to waste. A public service brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Alrighty. It feels so good to be back. Like I said, I enjoyed the dickens out of the time that I spent the last 3 days. And I'm going to be doing more of it, too, by the way, if our friends at Coal River Mountain Watch will have me, so to speak, go out and try to tell people what happens when you flip the light switch on, what it really means. Talk about that little steer wandering around out in the
out in the pasture and how, you know, it doesn't just disassemble itself and take itself and set itself inside the meat case at the grocery store, and that electricity is the same way. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm very, very much looking forward to doing more. But I am glad to be back, and I miss you guys when I am, when I'm gone. So, you know, thanks. Thanks for making this Thursday a very, very welcome return to the modern airwaves, so to speak. A little update for you, since it is the 7th day of February. We are 1 week into February. Just to let you know, we did not make our fundraising goal for January. Not by a long shot. We missed it by about, $1,200. So February, we're a week in, and it's the shortest month of the year, and we are standing at $160. This is getting a little creepy, guys. Bless your hearts. I mean, I know for those of you who are carrying the network on your backs, I cannot express, truly, I can't, what goes on in my heart and my mind when I realize the level of dedication that you put out to make this network keep going. For those of you who don't, if you can, please do. Like I said, we're a week into February. We're at $160, and March will be here before we know it. And that's a little bit distressing, shall we say. But I update you simply because I feel like you deserve to know. And we will go right now to the phones. Let's see who we've got. Hi, who have I got?
That's me, Kate.
Oh, hey, Kate.
Welcome home.
Well, thank you.
It was a long 3 days. Actually, it was a week, wasn't it? Because you weren't there Saturday and Sunday. I don't know. Whatever. Anyway, welcome back.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to make a brief call in because ennui is setting in. I'm not just tired. I am way past tired of this stuff. There's no place on the radio to listen to, nobody to hear talk. God, it's just awful.
That's why it really was refreshing for me to be gone, Kate, because, like I said, I didn't even take a computer with me. Given all the other electronic stuff I was taking, I figured I was probably courting disaster just by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, it turned out that when I got home, I opened my bag to unpack, and I had a little white piece of paper inside, and I checked my baggage, because I know what the baggage area on an aircraft is like.
Right.
So I checked my bags. I had a suit bag and a travel duffel. And I opened my bag, and I found this paper from the Transportation Security Administration, and it says, Notice of Baggage Inspection. To protect you and your fellow passengers, the Transportation Security Administration is required by law, tiny print, Section 110B of the Aviation and Transportation Security Act of 2001, 49 U.S.C. 44901, paren C through paren E, Rev 8-1204, Smart Security Saves Time, to inspect all checked baggage. As part of this process, some bags are opened and physically inspected. Your bag was among those selected for physical inspection. During the inspection, your bag and its contents may have been searched for prohibited items. At the completion of the inspection, the contents were returned to your bag. Well, you know, I had that $10,000 in gold when I started in my bag, and now it's not there.
You are a bona fide threat to national security.
Bob Kincaid, threat to national security. Exactly. Random,
that's
my butt.
Funny. Yeah, that is so funny. Oh, God, busted.
If the TSA security officer was unable to open your bag for inspection because it was locked, the officer may have been forced to break the locks on your bag. TSA sincerely regrets having to do this. However, TSA is not liable for damage to your locks resulting from this necessary security precaution.
And then if we still can't get it open, we're going to get on the airplane and shoot your ass.
Yeah, after we've machine-gunned the bag with the robot, you know, and CNN covers it. Bill, they have the robot on the tarmac.
The robot is approaching the bag behind the blast shield. Oh, my God, it looks like a bottle of tequila has been eradicated from the terror threat to America.
Because that's what... Oh, God.
Its owner is in Guantanamo as we speak.
In the secret prison we only found out about in the last day or so. Did you catch that?
Right.
We've got a secret concentration camp inside our public concentration camp.
Oh, God. And I hope you're just trying to act surprised.
Yeah, well, I ain't much of an actor. Somewhere amid the cactus-studded hill... Wait a minute. I gotta get the right voice for this. It's an AP story. Somewhere amid the cactus-studded hills of the sprawling Navy base, separate from the cells where hundreds of men suspected of links to Al-Qaeda and herding abused sheep and the Taliban have been locked up for years, is a place more closely guarded, a jailhouse so protected that its very location is top secret. We have a secret concentration camp inside the secret concentration camp. Oh, my God.
Now we all know it. Yeah, and we're going to get...
And they waterboard with Jell-O, by God, and you don't want that.
No. Oh, God. Okay, that's enough.
Stop it, Bob. Stop it. Just stop it.
just quit it. I want to know, I would like for... you to for the next hour. Oh God! For the next, see, you've already used up 15 minutes. For the next little bit, roll over the calls as they come in real quick, and have people check in from around the country. We have people in Tennessee, and I think somebody in Kentucky, Ohio, Wisconsin. Is Gary in Wisconsin?
No, Gary's in Maryland.
Oh, okay.
Albert is in Wisconsin.
Twin's dad's in Wisconsin.
No, twin dad is in Massachusetts.
Oh, God, they all look alike, them white boys. Anyhow.
But Albert has, I think, twin girls, and twin dad has twin boys, and we're working on an old-style Indian Ocean arranged marriage.
Oh, okay. Cool. I am really confused. What I'm asking...
You don't want to be me.
Damn sure. I would like for people to call in from all around the country and just check in and how are they, because it was a pretty big one down here, and I was just curious because I don't know how to get a hold of it.
That had to be creepy. I mean, have you seen any of the effects or anything?
No, I haven't. I was going to be over toward Oxford and where else over there? South of me and up around Tupelo, Oxford, and someplace else got creamed down there, too.
Molton, Alabama got whacked.
Well, that's what I thought. That's what I heard. And that was pretty creepy, too, because that's not far from me.
And then, of course, up in northern, north-central Tennessee just got blasted.
Yeah.
And we have listeners in that area, and I've already checked in to make sure that folks are okay.
Are they?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's what I wanted to know. So anyway, I just wish people would. I mean, how is it going in Washington? Washington was effectively isolated because I-90 was closed because of avalanches, and I-5 weather was really bad down into Oregon, and mudslides and stuff in California. And I just wanted to hear from people around the country and if we could do that, please. And thanks for doing the pitch. I didn't have to bring it up. We need money, folks. It's getting close to the end of the month already, and so I didn't have to do that.
No, I just checked the number, and it was like, eesh.
It's gonna suck when the mics go cold. So anyhow, because we can't watch the Republicans take over again, we got to listen to somebody else talking about it. And I just want to say, I don't know if Gary responded to it. I don't know what I didn't hear. It wasn't clear when my speaker's not very good. I'm just so amazed at the brouhaha and the circus that's going on around this election, this non-election, because this country, as I know this country, is no more ready to have a black man or a white woman or a black woman, never mind. We are not ready to have those people in the White House, neither one of them, or together. Can you imagine that? Envision that. Envision that. A black man and a white woman in the White House.
But America is, however, ready to have a halfway senile, crazy old white dude who's 71 years old in the White House and a power-mad, radical fundamentalist cleric watching every heartbeat waiting to turn into the guy. Yeah, that we're ready for.
Status quo. This country is not ready for a black man and or a white woman in the White House. I'm sorry. That just conjures up all kinds of mess in people's minds. This country is not ready. We have not evolved that far. Those old farts have to die and get all of the way so the kids can take over. The kids are already making the enthusiasm that we're seeing now. Those are coming up another generation behind us, and all those ugly old people got to die. We are not ready for a black man or a white woman to be president of the United States, let alone president, vice president. Oh, my God.
Let's be clear for a minute, though, Kate. You're not saying you're not ready for that. And you don't mean we normal people. You mean we hateful America.
I'm talking about the culture, yeah, that we hateful America. Yeah, this is not, I mean, there's nothing in this culture that indicates to me that this country's ready for that. Nothing. So, there you go.
Now, I saw ample proof that America's youth is ready for
that's
that.
That's what I just said.
I know you did. I know you did. I'm
the old guys got to die. They got to die and get the hell out of the way before the kids can take over. And hopefully, we're training the kids well. So, that's all I have to say. And I don't know much more about any of that, so I'm just, like I said, ennui has set in, and I'm just at a loss for things to do. So I'm anyway, I want to get off the phone. I'd like for people to check. Let's just have a roll call, a check-in, if people would do that.
Yeah, Mouseketeer roll call between now and 9 p.m. Eastern.
Oh, yeah, okay. Anyway, welcome back, and I'm just glad you're back on the air, and I hope people are as enthused about keeping the horn on the air as they are about dividing up the camp between this one and that one and trashing the other one and doing that, all that stuff. There's a lot of energy out there. If they can round up $3 million on Tuesday, then we ought to be able to come up with $3,000 by the end of the month. You know, I'm sorry. It's just, we got to do it. So, anyway, I'm done. I'm out of here. I'll be back.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, thanks for making it.
Bye.
Bye. I wait all night for calls like these. The new motto of the horn, I wait all night for calls like these. From Donald Fagan's The Night Fly. Inside joke, I guess. By the way, just to remind you, Rick Goodner has already confirmed that he will be honoring his commitment. Of course, you knew that. As far as building the studio, we're going to start buying materials probably tomorrow. So we're going to get started while we, you know, it's not great weather, but, you know, it's certainly sufficient for, you know, since we're under roof, we can darn sure start stuffing in insulation and putting up drywall. I like the idea. I like the idea of being in a new, fresh studio. I like the idea of maybe going to video, which means that I'm going to have to start getting serious about my appearance. Oh, listen to the ego. Listen to Ego Boy. But, yeah, just because of the offer that Rick made last month, you know that we're going forward on the construction project. On the other hand, it's getting a little dicey meeting the everyday obligations. And just to update you, overwhelming positive response on the idea of trying to cover the convention and in Denver. And just in case, it looks like this is not going to be one of those geeky, boring conventions either. We might get the smoke-filled room and something brokered. Although I heard Howard Dean say the other day that brokered conventions usually lead to Democratic disaster. Not encouraging. But somebody's got to be there to actually talk about real issues. As opposed to, you know, what's the candidate's favorite ice cream?
Eesh.
Now, some other stuff wandering around in the atmosphere in my absence. You know the waterboarding business. You know that yesterday the White House came out and admitted that it had used waterboarding and torture for purposes of eliciting information, good, bad, or indifferent. And you know that the logic runs this way with analysis by our good friend Wally at WD40.com. Asked whether the White House's reasoning was that torture is illegal, the Attorney General has certified that the interrogation practices are legal, therefore those practices are not torture. Spokesman Tony Fratto replied, sure. And Wally says, read that paragraph again. The reasoning goes like this. Torture is illegal. Mukasey says that waterboarding is legal. Therefore, waterboarding is not torture. Let's see. How does it work? The great logic segment from Monty Python. For given the proposition that all mackerel are fish and that all fish live underwater, my wife will conclude not that all mackerel live underwater, but that if she buys kippers, it will not rain, or that trout live in trees, or even that I do not love her anymore. This I call pure bullshit because it is not logical. Universal affirmatives are only partially convertible. All of Alma Cogan is dead, but only part of the class of dead people are Alma Cogan. Obvious, one might think. But not to Republicans. Okay, I added that part. Well, okay. Waterboarding's not torture, because waterboarding's legal, and if it was torture, it wouldn't be legal, so we can't do it anymore. Okay, any more questions? Thank you, bye. So you get that. We're not really torturing anybody, because we've already said that waterboarding isn't torture. Does anybody buy that kind of reasoning? Yes, sadly, yes. A lot of America buys that reasoning. Makes perfect sense to me, Eunice. Meanwhile, in the Why Hasn't This SOB Been Disbarred department, headline, prosecutor may have known of CIA tapes. See, yeah, you remember, we had movies. We made movies. Ready on the set, CB! We made movies of human beings being waterboarded and, yes, thereby tortured. And it turns out that the lead prosecutor in the trumped-up, dummied-up, phonied-up, faked-up, frauded, rubed-up case against that doofus Zacharias Moussaoui knew the CIA had destroyed tapes of the interrogations of an Al-Qaeda suspect more than a year before the government acknowledged to the court. That's as a result of newly unsealed documents in the case. The documents were declassified and released Wednesday by the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, the most hateful, conservative, miserable, crapulastic circuit court in the entire United States of America. And they demonstrate detailed efforts by Zacharias Moussaoui's lawyers to send the case back to a lower federal court to see if the tapes should have been disclosed, because they filed these requests for something called discovery. And it was not disclosed. In a December 18, 2007 letter to the appeals court's chief judge, the Justice Department acknowledged that its lead prosecutor in the case had been informed about the CIA's torture tapes of Al-Qaeda operative, so to speak, Abu Zubaydah. The letter went on to say that Robert A. Spencer, the lead prosecutor, may have even been told of the tapes' destruction in late February or early March of 2006. At the same time that the U.S. District Court in Alexandria, Virginia, was beginning its trial on whether Musawi would be eligible to face the death penalty. Robert Spencer should be disbarred. Robert Spencer withheld potentially exculpatory, I know, but you know what the word means because you're not a right-wing talk radio audience. You're an intelligent talk radio audience. The rules say that if the government is prosecuting somebody and is in possession of exculpatory information, exculpatory evidence, evidence that would tend to prove the innocence of the accused, then it must, not maybe, not sorta, not kinda, not, you know, if it's a day that ends in R, must disclose that exculpatory evidence to the defense. Robert Spencer, however, took out the judicial rules of the federal judiciary, opened his fly, whipped it out, and peed all over the law of this land. Another prosecutor in the office of U.S. Attorney Chuck Rosenberg, wasn't involved in the case, but recalls telling Robert Spencer on one occasion about the tapes. That second unnamed prosecutor learned about the tapes of Zubaydah, quote, in connection with work he performed in a Department of Justice project unrelated to the Musawi case. Nobody knows what that project was. It was probably the project to keep the Musawi defense lawyers from finding out about the tapes. But that's just me, because I'm a cynic. Spencer declined comment. You and I, we the people, pay Robert Spencer a boatload of money every year so that he can, what? Make a mockery of justice in this country? Because, you see, if evidence gathered from Zubaydah against Musawi was obtained as a function of the torture of Zubaydah, that evidence couldn't have been admitted against Musawi. It's a doctrine called the fruit of the poisonous tree. In other words, the tree's poison and the fruit that comes off of it is poison too, and you can't use it. But not in Bush world. Not in the coward nation, the COWERED nation, not in the coward nation, not in the nation that sits sucking its thumb huddled into a corner, quivering like a dog passing a peach pit at the thought of brown people. No, not in Bush America. We used to be a nation of laws. Now we are a nation of overzealous, politicized thugs. And it breaks my damn heart. And nobody will disbar Robert Spencer. Nobody will tell him that he has no right to be an officer of the court anymore. Nope, ain't gonna happen. And as I mentioned talking with Kate, meanwhile, under the glaring sun of a Cuban sky, we maintain a secret concentration camp that not even the International Committee of the Red Cross has been able to visit to see what the conditions are of the people who are warehoused there. Camp 7, it's called Lucky 7, where 15 so-called high-value detainees are held. Was just mentioned in passing this past December by attorneys for Majid Khan, a former Baltimore resident who was thought to have plotted to bomb gas stations in the United States? I don't know. With what? Tennis shoes the FBI bought him? Basketballs? You know the M.O. Under the gag order, we are prohibited from saying anything more about that camp. That was what Khan's defense lawyer said. The very notes that Khan's defense lawyer took in a consultation with his client were stamped top secret by the government. Oh, one of these days we're going to have that time machine. We're going to present these facts to Jefferson and Adams and say, fellas, what do you think? And they're all just going to tear up all of their work and walk away and send a message off by boat to the King of England, George III, and say, never mind, do-over, mulligan! It is a maximum security facility that was already built when George Bush announced in September 2006 that 14 high-value terrorism suspects had been transferred from the CIA's secret torture camps in Eastern Europe to Guantanamo. Not everybody, even within the Joint Task Force, has access or even knowledge of where Camp 7 is. Dear God. Congratulations, America. We do concentration camps that are secret, so nobody knows what goes on in them. Waterboarding? Maybe there's a diehard battery and some jumper cables with some testicles on the other end for all we know. Not inspiring. But as Dan Frumkin noted in the Washington Post in a headline site called "We Tortured and We Do It Again" in saying that, yeah, we've waterboarded and we'll waterboard whenever we want to. No laws, no regulations, no circumstances defining when it could or might not or would be used. That is sadly where we are. Mitt Romney is gone from the presidential election. Yeah, that's going to change things. Not. And our buddies, the people from whom we've learned so very, very much, our buddies, the Saudis. Did you catch this? Probably not. I mean, yeah, you guys might have, but it's none of the geniuses in the professional media have. A businesswoman was detained and strip-searched by Saudi Arabia's religious police for sitting in a Starbucks coffee shop with an unrelated man. This according to a report in the English-language Arab News. Quoting a 40-year-old financial consultant named only as Yara, as saying she was arrested by members of the powerful Commission for the Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice. Sounds like something the Southern Baptists would put together, doesn't it? She said she was holding a business meeting with a man in a branch of Starbucks in Riyadh. Why the hell Starbucks would want to do business with the Saudis is beyond me. In a section reserved for families. Yara said she was taken to a Riyadh prison. She was strip-searched, and then she was forced to sign a confession to having been caught alone with an unrelated man. An illegal act in the Holy Kingdom. The married mother of three, Yara, said, "I had no other choice but to sign. I was scared for my life. I was afraid that they would abuse me or do something to me. Wow. Strip searched. Forced to sign a confession. You know what? That's not torture in America. We used to be a country that would have looked down on that kind of filth. Yeah, and you're right. We need to ask the conservative Christians what kind of torture Jesus Christ would approve of. The sad thing about that, though, is we would be told that there was torture that Jesus would approve of, just as the Southern Baptists told us in late 2002, early 2003, that Jesus would approve of attacking Iraq. Don't blame me. It was the Southern Baptist Convention's statement on the war. The Mutawa in Saudi Arabia is the religious police. After she'd been strip searched, after she'd been confined, after she'd been tortured, after she'd been forced to sign a confession, she was released after her husband Hatim intervened. Hatim said, "I look at this as if she had been kidnapped by thugs. Hatim needs to shut up, or the Saudi religious police will cut out his tongue. And the Bush administration will say precisely nothing." Because there's slavery and then there's slavery, and this entire nation has been turned into slaves of a bunch of religiously insane thugs on the Arabian Peninsula. By the way, the man with whom Yara was having the business meeting remains in custody. He was arrested as well. He's a Syrian financial analyst. And we no longer have the moral high ground from which we used to be able to talk about this kind of stuff and to criticize it and to demand that the United States not have anything to do with it. This is the kingdom that has the power to call Dick Cheney and tell him to come over and get on his knees in the car in the carpet and be told what to do. And of course, you heard just a little bit ago the booing of John McCain over not being sufficiently hateful toward brown people. Inspiring. Absolutely inspiring. Romney, of course, used the CPAC to bow out of the race. And I've had a question put to me about Edwards and Romney both suspending as opposed to ending their campaigns. This has to do solely with their ability to get federal matching funds with which to pay their staffers. Romney said, "If I fight on in my campaign all the way to the convention, I would forestall the launch of a national campaign and make it more likely that Senator Clinton or Obama would win. And in this time of war, I simply cannot let my campaign be a part of aiding a surrender to terror." Does that make your blood boil? It makes me almost speechless. A surrender to terror. As if Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton have the surrender documents in their briefcase and on the day they are inaugurated are going to sign articles of surrender to an abstract noun. Hey, maybe it's all a secret plot to get Osama bin Laden out of hiding to come to the surrender ceremony so we can assassinate him. Ooh, aren't those Democrats smart? Yes, we are. But it's not just Romney out there saying that we'd surrender to terror. When in doubt, always go to big time Richard B. Dick Cheney. writing in the Chicago Tribune's The Swamp, Mark Silva notes, this morning at the start of the three-day conservative political action conference, said a Republican senator from Wyoming, quote, today the CNC PAC stands for Cheney. That's when Dick Cheney walked onto the stage and received a resounding, howling, screaming, weeping Beatles first appearance on Ed Sullivan ovation. I think Ann Coulter was the one in Bobby Socks crying. They roared their approval. It was Nuremberg-esque. And Cheney delivered an address . He said, we're going to revitalize America's economy at a time of challenge, and we're going to stay on the offensive in the war on terror. Wait a minute, let me do that right. We're going to revitalize America's economy at a time of challenge, and we're going to stay on the offensive in the war on terror. And then just to make sure that everybody understood how cool the war was, he said, guiding this nation through a time of peril is a very tough job, and the right man is in it. The absence of another 9/11 is not an accident, it's an achievement. As the president has made clear many times, we are dealing with a strategic threat to the United States. Then he made his little pitch for telecom immunity. Those who act in good faith to defend this country should not be hassled by lawsuits and trial lawyers. Damn lawyers. When the last chapter is written, it will be said that our nation became more prosperous and more secure because George Bush was the President of the United States. I've been proud to stand by George Bush, and I would support those same decisions today. You're damn right I would.
That's right. Even knowing what we know now, having murdered 1 million Iraqi civilians, I'd murder them all over again. You're damn right I would. Even knowing that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, I'd invade Iraq all over again. You're damn right I would.
I'm sorry. I just made the little hairs on the back of my neck stand up. Not because I do a really, really cool Cheney impression, but the idea that these fools, these unmitigated, hateful, thuggish, murderous fools, cannot even learn from their mistakes and would get in excess of 4,000 American soldiers killed again. You betcha.
You're damn right I would.
Almost makes you want to cry. And just in case, no. Let's don't say we didn't. Speaking of torture, and I can't figure out the UK government on this one to save my soul, Britain's Home Office has signed an extradition order that will send accused terrorist Abu Hamza al-Masri to the United States for prosecution. Al-Masri is one-eyed and hook-handed. He is pretty hateful. He is an imam, I guess. And he's preached a lot of hateful stuff, and he got one-eyed and hook-handed by fighting in Afghanistan against the Soviets. His followers include the so-called shoe bomber, Richard Reed, the guy who the reason we have to all take our shoes off to get on an airplane now, the stupidest-looking terrorist in the history of the world. You can look him up. And the guy that was convicted after the government withheld crucial, potentially exculpatory information, Zakarias Moussaoui. Yes, they both went to mosque services led by al-Masri. He's facing in the United States 11 terrorism-related charges. And Britain has agreed to extradite him to the U.S., where his confession to those 11 terrorism charges can be tortured out of him. A British judge last year sentenced al-Masri to 7 years for soliciting murder and inciting racial hatred. He was convicted in Great Britain of possessing items including a 10-volume encyclopedia of Afghani jihad. The prosecutor said that was a manual for terrorism. And he was also convicted of possessing videos and audio recordings, which prosecutors said he intended to distribute to stir up racial hatred. Now, there's no doubt he is a hateful, vile POS. Okay? The question is, however, can Great Britain be sure, absolutely sure, that upon extraditing him to the United States, he will not be tortured or subjected to anything that British law says that British law couldn't subject him to? And the answer to that question, of course, is no, Great Britain cannot. He will be tortured before he's shuffled off to that maximum security prison in Colorado somewhere that now houses the Unabomber, the blind sheik, the sheik who wears poorly coordinated clothing, and 15 different versions of Al-Qaeda's number two. What a world, what a world, what a world, what a world. Mind-boggling, isn't it? Just mind-boggling. And just so you can have a giggle, let's end this on a high note. It turns out that the Crystal Methodist, the Reverend Ted Haggard, has bugged out of his program, his spiritual restoration. He has asked to prematurely end his rehabilitation from being a meth-smoking, man-loving minister of the gospel. New Life Church issued a statement this past Tuesday saying it believes the termination of the relationship is premature, but they wouldn't say why. I don't know, maybe after months and months and months in this program, Haggard broke down and said, I want me a man. I'm out of my bailiwick at this point. So it's hard to say. Haggard now lives in Phoenix and will remain as a member of Phoenix First Assembly of God. Pastor Tommy Barnett will maintain what New Life called an accountability relationship. The statement says, New Life Church recognizes the process of restoring Ted Haggard is incomplete and maintains its original stance. One wonders if the stance is wide, of course. Maintains its original stance that he should not return to vocational ministry. However, we wish him and family only success in the future. So the team, the oversight team, has agreed to his request to end the oversight of his recovery program. The mind reels. So if you're in Phoenix, keep an eye out on the little parking lots and shady alleys and byways where meth gets sold. You never know. You just might see an American social celebrity. You might just see Ted Haggard going out to buy some meth for his date. Thanks, y'all. Wonderful evening. Thanks for all the input, the emails. Those that I don't get to on the air, I do try to answer in writing off air. Thanks for being you and being there. It's awful good to be home. Thanks to our audio engineer, John Fox, to our IT professional, Peter Godbold, on his way with the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio program, Strictly Confidential. Thanks to the hardest working man in liberal talk, a man we need to clone six or seven more of, Ben Birch. Thanks ever so to all the dedicated members of Coal River Mountain Watch, fighting and succeeding and making a difference and proving that we are indeed a part of the solution and an end of the problem of mountaintop removal. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you. We'll be right back.
right. Now all that's left.
This is the Quality News Network. In Grand Rapids, Michigan today, tens of thousands of mourners visited the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Museum to pay their respects to the late president.
Gather around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the Dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 114, Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, exclusively on the listener-supported Head-On Radio Network. Also brought to you by Coal River Mountain Watch, that's CRMW.net. Coal River Mountain Watch, and we appreciate their support, too. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Thursday, February 7, 2008. So if you are listening shortly after 9 p.m. on a Thursday, that is February the 7th, 2008, that's 9 p.m. Eastern, you are indeed listening to a live show, and you're welcome to call in and participate with myself and to our two guests, count them one, two, who I'll be introducing shortly. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests, as well as to the guests' websites and the audio from previous shows in case you come across a guest that you would like to hear that you may have missed, those of you who stream via iPod or the archive streams. You'll find it all arranged in a calendar format. It's easy to locate. You'll also find links there to the chat room. That's the Head-On Radio Network chat room, which is active as I speak. You'll find links there to the Head-On Radio Network main site where you can participate in helping listener-supported progressive radio continue, keeps the stream streaming and the cassettes turning and the CDs spinning and the packets passing. You'll find a PayPal button there. You'll find out about the other progressive programming on the Head-On Radio Network. We have a widely varied schedule, all of them progressive and all of them very proud to be a part of the Head-On Radio Network, of only which I'm only a very small part of. We have hosts as far away as Australia and in D.C. and South Florida. I'm in North Florida. We have hosts just spread out all over the place. It's amazing how we managed to pull this off. But all the right people came together at all the right time. It's a magical experience, the thing that the Head-On Radio Network is made of. You'll find links at strictlyconfidentialradio.com also for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and a link there to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. To contact the show, you can use 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366. Those are toll-free lines. If you have unlimited long distance, you should use that to help save the studio a nickel or buck. We are listener-supported. So if you do have unlimited long distance, please use that. Use area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. That rings in West Virginia. And we're glad to pay the freight if you'd like to call toll-free, but we welcome your calls on either line.